Hi, folks. I'm Dakota Cohen. Thank you so much for checking out the Building Your Homestead podcast, where I talk with expert guests about agriculture, health, economics, technology, philosophy, and other topics that I believe will help us to peacefully exit the increasing tyranny of our world and start building a parallel system, one homestead at a time.
Welcome to the Modern Homesteading Podcast. This is your host, Rachel Jameson, and today I'm joined by Dakota Cohen. And Dakota is a permaculturist. I'm going to let you introduce yourself and what exactly it is you're doing and what you're linked to with like your website and stuff before we get into it.
Yeah, thanks so much, Rachel. So yeah, I was born and raised on a 250-acre mixed organic farm in central Alberta, Canada, and basically I knew I wanted to be a farmer my whole life. I spent a few years in getting my carpentry ticket, just because you can't make any money farming. That's what I was taught growing up. So right. I figured I'd have to go off farm to make my money. But around 2012. Is when I just really started to click things together in terms of, the problems that I was seeing in the world and, my passion for agriculture. And I started to go beyond the kind of organic world into things like permaculture, holistic management, regenerative agriculture was just kind of starting then as well. And yeah, basically since that time, it's just been a black hole of running experiments on our farm. And that turned into, doing tours and then people asking me if I would do consulting and workshops. And now that's actually a big part of what I do is helping basically other homesteaders and farmers anywhere in the world to design and develop land for their own freedom, purpose, and abundance.
Okay, very cool. So when you said you went and I've never heard of it referred to that, but you are from Canada, a ticket, yeah. Which means, is that similar to getting your journeyman's?
Yes. Yeah. It's red seal journeyman ticket.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And then, so your plans were probably not to be on the farm, or did you enjoy being on the farm? A lot of kids get burned out.
Yeah. I'm the youngest of six, and the other five all got burned out for sure. And I think it's cause I was the youngest that I didn't get burned out. Cause a lot of the hard heavy lifting was done before I came along.
Okay.
Yeah, I always knew that I was going to be a farmer. Like from some of my earliest memories were, helping dad with chores. But I also knew that I wasn't going to farm the way that we farmed.
Okay.
There was, from an early age, I can remember having thoughts of just like, this sucks. Like there's gotta be a better way. Whatever we're doing, whether we were, working with pigs or cows or in the garden or, in our orchards, there was always just thought of like, how could this be better, more efficient, less work? That was always with me. And then when I found permaculture, I literally was like, I think the first 5 minutes of research on it, I was like, this is going to be the rest of my life.
So how did you find it? What?
I literally searched. One day I just searched. I knew I wanted to come back to the farm, but I knew I didn't want to farm the way that my parents did. And this is nothing against them. Like they were doing,
yeah, right.
My dad grew up on an industrial farm. Before we got on, you were talking about how, I think it was your husband's folks were kind of from the 80s. That was the really peak industrial ag. And for folks who grew up before that, where there was just so much drudgery in farm work, yeah. Like fertilizer and glyphosate and herbicide, they were a godsend for these people, yeah. and magic, basically. And mm-hmm. So for them, they got hooked on it really, really quickly because it cut their workload in half. And there were a lot of, benefits or short-term benefits that it seemed like, it was a good product. But of course it was too good to be true. And so, that's how my dad grew up. They were farming a couple thousand acres, hogs and barns, feedlots for cattle. and they had chickens and they milked cows, but everything was a monoculture. So the pigs were here, the cows were here, the chickens were here, the grain was over here, the hay was over here. Everything was separate. And we can get into this later with permaculture, but that's the reason they were so much work is because they were separate. In ecosystems, everything is interconnected, and the waste products of one element become the resources of another. And so, you know, the essence of permaculture is how to mimic ecosystems so that you can achieve that same that same kind of efficiency. Come back to my story, you know, growing up on a organic farm, my dad made the transition from industrial agriculture to organic agriculture in 1988.
Okay.
Which was before the internet.
Yes.
Right. So this was very, very early, and there were basically no resources, and they struggled for years. There was no help at that time, especially in our area. There was only like one or two other farmers that were doing it, and they didn't have, they were basically just grain farmers. They didn't have the mixed aspect that we did.
Oh, just grain. Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, we had, you know, pigs and chickens and cows and dairy animals, and we did grain. And
yeah,
so
I totally get it. I'm probably just a little bit younger than your parents, but we also, you know, we grew up without the internet, and it definitely is research. It's just the internet has broadened our horizons so much, the good and the bad. And it's 20, you know, hindsight's 20/20. My mm-hmm. husband was raised with parents that grew up at the end of the Depression, the Great Depression. Yeah. And so for them, the chemicals were amazing.
Yes.
Like you said, it saved so much time.
Yeah.
And, you know, they didn't know what we know now. And so, I'm not blaming them. It's just how it was. And hindsight's 20/20. And now we know that there's ways to do what you're doing. So when you decided that you were going to start moving towards permaculture, since your parents went from industrial ag to organic ag, I'm going to assume that they were kind of excited about this, but still maybe hesitant.
Yeah. They've been super supportive with everything that we've done, and they've come like, they're right on board right now. But yeah, there was some feet dragging at the beginning, mostly because the stuff was just so, part of it was because some of the ideas were kind of far out there. And also part of it was because a lot of the resources about permaculture are kind of backyard gardens. Like it's very, very, very small scale.
Yeah.
So it took me a while to kind of navigate the resources. Like the first PDC or the permaculture design course that I took, it didn't really have anything to do with agriculture. It was all kind of small scale gardening, which is nothing wrong with that.
Right.
But when you get back to the original stuff that Bill Mollison did, like permaculture originally meant permanent agriculture. It was absolutely like a large scale agricultural system for land design. And then later on, it was broadened into permanent culture. So it was all aspects of you know, human society, ranging from financial systems to educational systems to, you know, buildings and gardens and crops and all this stuff. So I think a lot of the resistance that they had is the crazy ideas I was trying to try out on our farm. They just weren't going to work, and they saw it ahead of me. And I was, you know, frustrated and just, you know, it's going to work. We got to try. And now that we've kind of dialed that in, you know, our workload has never been less. We've never been more profitable. Every year our land gets healthier. It seems like it's too good to be true, but when you start to partner with the ecosystem processes, like magic starts to happen. And it is the kind of real magic that I think the industrial kind of green revolution was looking for, except as opposed to coming from a laboratory, it's coming from, you know, nature.
Now, when you look at, I've seen the aerial photos and video of your place, and people will be able to go to the links that we're going to provide to look at that. did it look totally different? Because now you have this all designed, and that must have taken just a ton of work for you to totally change all.
Yeah, like you can go back in if you have like Google Earth Pro or any kind of GIS systems, and you can go back and see the old photos, satellite photos of our farm. Like in 2012, when I first took my permaculture design course and came back, like our farm was indistinguishable from any other farm. You know, we were doing full tillage. We had all the wetlands were drained. We had our cows were basically in feedlots for 6 to 8 months out of the year, even though they were organic. Like the only thing that we weren't doing is we weren't using fertilizer and chemicals, but everything else was just as industrial as everybody else. And every year our yields got less. We had more weed problems. Like things were going downhill. So just because you don't use chemicals and fertilizer doesn't mean you're a good farmer. And that was a big insight for us, is that it's a lot more than just not doing.
And I think using the
chemicals.
I think a lot of people don't understand that organic farming, most industrial scale organic farming, is still industrial, and it still looks almost exactly the same.
Yeah.
When you drive by it, you probably really can't tell the difference.
No.
And permaculture is just so, it's vastly different.
Yeah.
So you started doing this, and you started changing the property. Mm-hmm. And what, I guess just get into that and how, because you're doing some really cool stuff.
Yeah. So one of the things we started out with was redesigning our farms, kind of relationship to water. so in our area, we usually get only about 12 inches of rain a year, or 300 millimeters if you got some folks on the metric system. And in the wintertime, we would only get, you know, the equivalent of, say, you know, 2 or 3 inches of rain. We don't get a lot of snow. Maybe a foot. Like this year, we've been in a bad drought for a couple of years, and this year we might have gotten the equivalent of like less than an inch of rain in our snow, like maybe 6 inches of snow. And it's light, fluffy snow. It's not like the wet snows that you guys get down, you know, where you're at, where it's like,
yeah, I'm in Michigan. Half, so we get yeah, lots of one. Snow and yeah. lots of rain.
Yeah. Yeah.
Except for the last 2 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like we're lucky, and where I live, if you go, you know, even 30 minutes kind of in any direction, you'll either get drier or wetter. So I'm kind of right in the middle, but just, yeah, half hour away from where I live, there's not enough moisture for trees to grow naturally. Like short grass prairies. Yeah.
Like where you're at, you've obviously tried to bring trees back, but I've noticed around you, there's not a lot.
Yeah. And that's largely just because of the industrial agriculture, you know, clearing trees to grow annual crops. But like I said, just a few miles down the road, you can't even grow trees if you wanted to naturally, or they don't grow wild because there's just not enough moisture. Okay. So, and then tag that on top of it with the fact that, you know, our water tables have been dropping for 100 years. So my great, great grandparents settled here, back in 1914, they literally built their log cabin to the side of a hill. And, you know, raised a few kids there. But they had hand dug wells that they were getting fresh water out of the ground. Now, like, our springs are gone. There's no creeks flowing year round in our area. And our wells are hundreds of feet deep. So like this ecological degeneration has been happening for a long time. So fast forward to, you know, when I was a kid, you know, we had already burned through 2 wells by the time I was born. And you know, when the cows came in to drink water, we had to like time when we're going to shower and wash clothes, because there wasn't enough water from our well. We would get about a half a gallon a minute production out of our well. So then we tried to dig another well, and that wasn't great either. And it's kind of salty water. So anyways, when I came back to the farm and I was like, I want to plant orchards and, you know, do all this crazy stuff, it was like, well, where are we going to get the water from? And we knew we couldn't go down, so we had to look up. And then it's funny because I just had this memory at the time of a kid. My favorite time of the year was the spring runoff, where there's that, you know, two, three weeks of, you know, basically there's just rivers flowing everywhere and then they're gone. And it hit me. That's like, I wonder how much water that is. And I started doing the math on it, and literally we're in this desert and everyone complains about water all the time. And yet for 2 weeks of the year, there's like millions of gallons of water that are flowing through most people's properties and they didn't even know it. And we didn't even know it. So with that, we started to like, okay, how do we basically slow spread and infiltrate that resource to help, you know, solve this problem. And that led us to experiment with a lot of different things, key line subsoiling, swales, dugouts, dams, flood irrigation, doing kind of beaver dam analogs, which is kind of like mimic what beavers would have done in the landscape. Because just 100 years ago, there were beavers on our farm.
Right, yeah.
And so that was really the first piece that we had the most success was mimicking that natural pattern of slowing, spreading, and infiltrating water into the ground. And it's just been phenomenal. Like when I was a kid, there was not standing water on our farm anywhere on our 250 acres.
That's crazy, because I've seen it now.
Now every year, so we our yearly water budget is about 250,000 gallons or 1 million liters of water, and quite a few years in a row now we've harvested 10 million gallons of water just in that 2 weeks. So that's 40 years worth of the water that we use every year in terms of our domestic like household uses, livestock, you know, any irrigation type stuff. So we're basically at like a 40-to-1 ratio of we take 1 year out, we put 40 years back. And we've done that a few years in a row now. The last couple of years have been a bad drought and like no one's had any water. But even on those years, we've still been getting, you know, 1 million gallons a year.
So where are you storing that? In ponds or do you have
Ponds. Yeah, ponds, dams, wetlands, our swales. So like actually like the organic matter in the soil is one of the largest water storing, and it's one of the most cost-effective water storage systems you can use. Like at 1% organic matter, you can hold about 15,000 gallons in the top foot of soil. But if you increase it to every 1%, you increase it, it basically increases it another 15,000 gallons up to 4%. So you can go from, if you raise from 1% to 4%, it's an extra 45,000 gallons per acre, per foot of topsoil. And to go from 1% to 4% is not hard. Like in carbon, that's quite easy. There's guys like Gabe Brown down in North Dakota. He's improved from less than 1% to over 8% carbon. In just a decade. That's been the biggest kind of impact, I think, that's really helped everything else on our farm to thrive is addressing that our weak link in our ecosystem was water. And once we solved that, now we have trees like wild trees growing in our swales. We have, you know, the muskrats have come back. When there wasn't, like my dad, when he was a kid, he used to, you know, shoot muskrats and hunt them for their pelts on our land. And there hasn't been any on our farm for decades. But the first pond that we built, and once it filled, there was a muskrat in it like the next day.
Isn't that wild? Like where does it come
from? Where does it come from? Yeah.
It. Yeah. They just found it. That's cool.
And so that's the magical part of this regeneration work is that There is a force in the universe that wants to create something out of nothing. You know, you can call it, you know, God or ecosystems or the force or whatever you want to call it. But there is a force in the universe that wants to create something out of nothing. And it has been for a long time. And when you stop fighting that force and you work with it, you can speed it up. It's not drudgery. It's like vocation. It's productive work. It's one of the most fulfilling things. Well, the most fulfilling thing I've ever done in my life is to partner with that force in the universe. And it makes my life better, makes everyone else's life better around me.
Yeah. Like so what you do.
That's what we do.
Designs to assist in making this. That's pretty cool.
And so what's wild is it's had ramifications beyond our own property. So like we used to have to like schedule our showers, as I was saying. Now, like we waste water. Like we'll use 3,000 gallons a day just to irrigate our lawns and our gardens. Whereas like, we would have never dreamt of doing that, 30 years ago when I was a kid. But it's actually expanded onto our neighbors now, where we gave a farm tour a few years ago, and one of our neighbors came, and after the tour, they approached me and they said, "So that's why our well has been getting better."
Wow, that's what's amazing about permaculture to me.
Yeah, yeah, and so it's like where I was saying we put 40 years of water back into the ground. That's recharging the aquifers. I was saying before, we didn't have standing water. So there were no wetlands, no sloughs, no creeks on our property. I've had some years where the creek that we made flowed for half the summer. Like it flowed steady, even though we don't get a lot of rain for half the summer. Now that's only happened once. It was a really good runoff year and we had right. decent moisture. But like I guarantee it, before I die, there will be a creek that will flow year round on my property. Right to the winter, even. I have no doubt about it. And there wasn't even one before. That's what's cool is if you go back, 100 years before it was this land was settled, there wasn't even a creek then. So we're gonna make it better than it was, before we started to degenerate it.
So have you taken when you said that they had filled in the ponds? So did you put the ponds back? You obviously put the ponds back in, so you dug those back out. And did those just kind of then naturally start reverting to what you have now, which is cattails and the duckweed and all that?
Yeah. So the there weren't necessarily ponds before. It was like wetlands. So this would be, there was a few spots where there were beavers. So the beavers will, if there's a foot or two of water that stays year round, they'll actually dig out. A spot deep enough in the middle where they can build their dam and their lodge and live, right through the winter. But there was nothing, major. But what had been happening for about 100 years is that those wetlands were slowly drained. And so, basically is in a dry year, what farmers do is they just cultivate it and then they just ditch. And they're constantly trying to get it to run off. And if it pools up anywhere, then they'll dig that part out. And it's kind of like cut and fill. And where they'll cut a high spot, fill it into the low spot just to get everything to run off. And by the time my dad bought the farm, it was like they had done a good job. there was no water anywhere that could stand on our farm. So all I did is we went back and using topographical maps, you can see where these points in the landscape where they did the cutting and filling. And I just closed them off. I just kind of built a little dam here. And so now we have spots where, a 20-foot tall dam wall or a road that's, a 20-foot long, that's only like 2 or 3 feet tall, backs up 5 acres of water. Okay. And there's 330,000 gallons of water in an acre foot. So it's huge.
Your ponds are pretty shallow then.
Some of them, but then I have other dams that are in the landscape because those wetlands are more for infiltration and for growing cattails, as you're saying, but I have other ponds that are 20 feet deep and they're for irrigation and access to water, year round, because even if it freezes, it's not going to, the ice won't take all the water away. Yeah.
And did you dig those that deep then?
Those were all done with excavators and bulldozers and stuff like that.
Yeah, because that's what I was wondering. Like if you don't have a natural wetland on your property, you can come in and dig those and
absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. And then in addition to that, we built a network of they're called swales. Or berms and basins, which basically connects all these dams and wetlands together, so that say when one fills up, then it would overflow into this swale, almost like an eaves trough system on your house, and then it would convey it to the next one. And when that one's filled, it conveys it to the next one, and it just, now a drop of water that were to fall on the top of our property might take 3 kilometers before it can leave.
Right. That's cool.
So we have over 3 kilometers of these swales on our property, plus about probably 10 million gallons of actual water storage in terms of these dams and kind of renovated or man-made wetlands.
So you have, I watched a recent video, which is available on your website, where you did an interview with Curtis Stone.
Yep.
And you talked about the fish, the fathead minnows that you're using. Do those go in the bigger ponds or are those in the shallower ponds? Like, how is all that?
So they're fathead minnows are kind of a bait fish that's ubiquitous anywhere in the world. And, they just showed up on our property, but now we're actually able to cultivate them by creating habitat for them to lay their eggs. And so that they will live in the shallower water, but they'll freeze in the winter. But in our deep ponds, absolutely. Yeah. They live right through the winter and, they're super, super prolific. I think a single female will lay 3,000 eggs in her lifespan. And in 90 days, those eggs will get to 2 inches long. So almost like the size of a small sardine, you'd see in a can, and they're delicious. The females, the females are quite good. The males have, because of the hormones that they produce, they have a bit of a chemical-y taste, but the females are just as good as sardines.
I love sardines, honestly.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And you can literally, you fry them up, you eat the whole thing, like bones and all. They're they're that small. And, but I haven't done it for a few years, but we did some experience feeding them to pigs and chickens and dehydrating them for like pet treats and stuff like that. And yeah, it's really phenomenal. The challenge is, in Canada, we're not like the States in a lot of ways, where it's illegal to do aquaculture here with native species. So it's $400,000 fine if you're caught with a live fish more than 10 feet away from a body of water.
Wow.
So it's pretty, pretty tricky. If I was in the States, the aquaculture is one of the most undervalued and most abundant and most secure and like the lowest hanging fruit in terms of food production and just value that any homesteader could do is get into aquaculture. Find whatever native species live in your ecosystem and learn how to create habitat for them and build an ecosystem. So it's not just one fish. You're getting all the different layers and niches that they fill in the ecosystem. And
Wow. I forget about, just the rules and the laws and how they stop us from doing some of the things that we want to do.
It's pretty sick. Yeah. Yeah.
I forgot to ask what grow zone you're in.
We'd be like a zone. Yeah. We'd be like a zone 3.
I thought so. Wow. That's because I'm 5 and that's difficult enough. So your last freeze date must be like into June.
It's usually May 15th.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's kind of September 15th to May 15th.
That's kind of ours too, but then you get probably colder than we do.
Yeah. Yeah. We had minus 50 here, minus 50 degrees Celsius. Minus 40 and minus 40 are the same for Fahrenheit and Celsius, but we actually hit minus 50 for about a week.
That's cold. Yeah. We got, I think the coldest we ever got. Now I'm not great at converting with Celsius. The coldest we got was, I think it was 2014. We were down like a negative 28 for a couple of weeks and we lost our peach trees. So that's pretty cold.
It is.
So you're doing all that there, which is pretty amazing. And so can you start talking about, I guess, just your whole system and how your farm works? I'm familiar with it because I've been, of course, watching all of your videos, but I don't know how many of the listeners are familiar with how your system is working on your farm, because you're growing food crops, but you're also integrating that in with animals and growing animals and fruit trees. And So
yeah. So there's been a few years where the only thing we've purchased off farm has been a few machinery parts, some baler twine, some salt for our cattle, and 500 gallons of diesel. And like when we produce everything else, like all of our grain, all of our hay, all of our straw, all of our vegetables, all of our fruit, all of our eggs, our milk, our meat, we make our own cheese. And that's really where it's like the reason I do this is more for the homesteading side of things. Like we want to feed ourselves first and then kind of sell the surplus afterwards. Right. So we have a, you know, a production farm, and we sell, you know, about 30 or 40 pigs a year and about 15 or 20 beef and the berries and eggs and stuff like that. But it's mostly for the self-sufficiency aspect that we, why we're doing this. And so in terms of like, you know, all the systems, and I don't know how, if you want to go into like the specifics on certain things, but the summary is like our farm is an ecosystem, like every aspect of it, like the way that, you know, the animals and the grasses and the trees are designed and laid out and managed is we're just trying to mimic ecosystem processes. I'll also add in that we haven't used any fertilizer or herbicides or antibiotics or any chemicals for 30 years on our farm, which I think is something that people are taken aback by, because it's just so ubiquitous, even in the homesteading space, where, you know, you always got to have kind of the drugs on call.
Right.
Well, what I've found is that, you know, any weed or pest or parasite or disease is simply an indicator that something is out of balance in your ecosystem.
Okay.
And so you can use, you know, some of these drugs or chemical products to address symptoms, but it will never address the root cause. And once you address the root cause of whatever is causing it, it never happens again. And, you know, one of the things
You're not even using organic chemicals or fertilizers. This is all a closed loop system.
Yeah.
Going on.
Yeah. Yeah. So we used to use things like diatomaceous earth, or I would use, you know, like herbal antiparasiticals, like, you know, wormwood or garlic or things like that. Like I'll give you an example. We used to struggle with mastitis with our dairy cows, which I think is quite common for, a lot of people. And over the course of about 5 years of experimentation, I've realized that mastitis is not a bacterial infection. It's not caused by dirty straw or not using the teat dips or, you know, all the things that people say. It has nothing to do with that. What it is separation anxiety that the cows have with their calves.
I remember hearing you say this.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah.
So other people
can hear this. So and at the time when I figured this out, I wasn't aware of it, but now I've discovered a new, there's a new system of health called Germany medicine, that basically follows the same idea, which is that all quote diseases or human illnesses are biologically meaningful and they're actually good. So the diseases are there to actually either protect us or help us heal from a particularly stressful event. And so we basically have, you know, all mammals, and I think plants as well, because this is where the diseases and pests come in for them. But we all have, we've evolved for, you know, very long periods of time to have like if with the mastitis, for example, I was only getting it when my dairy cows were on a certain pasture. And it happened the same whenever I moved them to that pasture. Every year they got mastitis on that. And as soon as they moved them off that pasture, the mastitis went away. It took me 5 years to figure that out, but right. Through process of elimination, eventually I realized, okay, what am I doing differently about that pasture versus any other one? And the difference was that pasture was across one of our main roads. And so with dairy cows, typically, or the way that we do it is we lock the calves up at night so that in the morning, you know, the mothers are standing by their calves. You milk them before you let them out with their calves. The calves get the rest. And then all day long, the calves take the second milking, and it reduces work for us and, you know, a bunch of benefits. So the difference was in this one pasture that they were on is because it was across a road, the cows couldn't come back to see their babies at night.
Oh, okay.
That was the only difference. Every other pasture, the cows could go in the little shed that I kept their babies in. They could go in and touch noses with their babies and just say, hey, how's it going? Okay, you're safe. I'll go back and graze. They were only 50, 60 feet away. They could literally see each other across, but there's a fence in between them and they couldn't physically touch. Oh. And that's where they were getting this mastitis. And as soon as I changed that design where I just made an alleyway so they could come back and see their babies, I haven't had mastitis since.
I mean, it just makes so much sense, you know, as a mom that breastfed her kids, all of the hormones that take place during that physical touch, it makes it awesome.
Yep. And so if you get into the germinal medicine theory of what mast, because it's the same in humans, is that if you have a separation conflict with your child, you as a mother will want to produce more milk to help soothe your baby. Okay. So that when you are reunited, you'll be able to, you know, help to soothe them. And so when these calves and were bawling at their mothers all night long, they're getting stressed out, even though they can literally see each other across this pen. Yeah. It didn't matter. And so the mastitis, it's not a disease or an illness. It's actually there to help the mothers produce more milk.
Interesting.
And so if you take that same analogy, and I don't want to get into the weeds on this, but without exception, every single disease, illness, without exception, is the result of some kind of a conflict or something that's out of balance in the ecosystem. And this is the same thing with weeds too. I talked about this on the webinar with Curtis, but if you damage the same piece of ground 10 different ways with compaction, fertilizer, fire, flood, salt, tillage, chemicals, you can do the same piece of ground and just do little experiments. Different weeds will grow out of the different spots that you did the different damage to.
Right.
And so these weeds are there to help repair whatever was out of balance in the ecosystem to bring it back into the productive state that it was and to lift it higher in the successional cycle. And so like really the secret to like our success is just realizing that, you know, there's been 2.5 billion years of research and development that's gone on before we got our farm, and to realize that we can learn a lot from that and stop trying to override it and fight with it and just be like, okay, something's out of balance here. I guarantee it's me, not the ecosystem, that's doing something wrong. And so how do I step back and learn from this? And that's it. Whether I'm trying to figure out how to, you know, move animals through our farm in a stress-free way, or how to grow our gardens without, you know, excessive tillage, or we've got, you know, diseases on our fruit trees or whatever it is, that's the approach. It's just as an old kind of scientist named Victor Schauberger, his mantra was comprehend and copy nature. It's like,
kind of what permaculture is in a very simplified nutshell, is observation and then learning to mimic nature.
Yep.
But assist it. Cause I do think, I mean, I've been watching, I also been watching Ben Folk, and just letting things go fallow doesn't usually work well either. And
No. And I think that's like the other extreme. So like in the industrial side of things, we try to like kind of command and control and, you know, just, it's very, very top down, very militaristic in our approach, our relationship to ecosystems. And then the flip side of this with a lot of kind of permaculturists or regen folks is just kind of this nature is precious and tender, and like, we don't want to hurt it. And so we just need to like pussyfoot around it. It's like, no, like there have been asteroids and super volcanoes and, you know, glaciers that just destroy this planet literally back to bedrock, and it keeps bouncing back better than it was before. And so we are actually an integral part of this ecosystem. And if we, as an organism within that ecosystem, learn our proper role, we can actually speed up that process.
Yeah. I mean, we're seeing that so much with what you're doing, with what Joel Salatin's doing, with what Ben Folk's doing. I mean, just that ability to build soil and regenerate an ecosystem and turn it back into something very productive. And that's one of the, I was going to ask you, do you, you know, you have all these systems. I'm trying not to make assumptions because in case people haven't seen the videos that you have out on YouTube and stuff, but do you rotationally graze? I mean, I know you've
talked
a little bit about that. How does that work with all of these systems that you've got with your swales and your ponds and some of the foods that you're feeding your animals and then the labor intensiveness? Because you said you're working less than you ever have. Is that all?
Yeah. So the I'll talk about the kind of the broad pattern of the ecosystem first. And so anywhere you are on the planet, if you were to walk away from a piece of land and do nothing for 100 years and just watch it, if you could speed that process up, that's called succession, what you would find is that ecosystems will, anywhere in the world, will have a predictable pattern that they will evolve through. And the species will be different, but the pattern's always the same. It starts with pioneer organisms, which are really short-lived, aggressive. They're typically thorny and just tough. And it will progress into longer and longer lived species that are more and more sensitive or kind of Goldilocks in their approach to, like, they need a very, small range of windows that they can tolerate. And so the pioneer organisms basically pave the way for the climax species or the climax ecosystem to evolve. And that climax ecosystem will be different anywhere in the world. Some places it's a savanna, ecosystem where with trees and grasses. Some places it's boreal forest. Some places it's jungle or rainforest. Some places it's short grass prairie, tall grass prairie. Some places there's desert ecosystems, and that's the climax is certain species of desert ecosystems. So the broad approach to our farm is this kind of comprehend and copy nature. So if we ask that question for my property, if I walked away for 100 years, what would my land turn into? It's an aspen parkland biome, which is groves of trees interspersed with grassland. And you can go back in historical photos and you can see this. So it would have been like, trees around the wetlands, because that was the only place that they could grow. And everything else would have been pasture or grazing land that the bison or buffalo and elk and we used to have grizzlies here. It's they would all, go in and out of the forests. And so that was the original insight that led us to kind of, in addition to building these swales across our property, which are typically about like 100 or 200 meters or yards apart, we just planted trees along those because that's where trees like to grow. And we fenced those off so the animals can't muck around in the water and the wetlands and stuff. And then we have these grazing alleyways, which are perfect for cross fencing. So you just imagine these kind of long, narrow strips, and they're curvy because they follow the contours of the land, that have water lines that run along them. So it's really easy to move water tanks. So the cows always have access to fresh water without having to walk a long distance. And that's the broad pattern of our farm. And if you go on, you can see pictures of on my websites, or my YouTube channel, where you can just see this pattern and just like, oh, of course that's what the land wants to be there. And we just move our animals through these alleyways back and forth, usually on like a 30 to 60 day rotation. And typically we move them once a day, sometimes more. And it takes a few minutes to move as fast as you can walk. You can put up one of these cross fences and take one down. It's all electric now. Every year we're seeing an increase in our productivity of our pastures, our yields. Increasing health in our animals. They grow faster every year. They use less mineral. They use less supplements.
The minerals, that's that part I think is awesome because you see a lot of people use a lot of minerals, especially if you're not on great soil. So you're obviously building soil and your plants are uptaking all those minerals and they're
absolutely
needing less.
Yeah. That's amazing. Absolutely. Yeah.
And you have pigs. You have pigs, beef, and dairy cows, and chickens. Do you have other
Those are the main domesticated species. We've had a few ducks here and there, and a few horses and a few sheep, but the main ones are pigs, chickens, beef cow, and the pigs, chickens, and the dairy cows. They're kind of part of one ecosystem. Our beef cows are usually separate, just because they don't require as much management, so they can go further away from our inner zones. But yeah, those animals, like chickens, dairy, some kind of a dairy animal, and pigs are like the holy trinity of
that's what I was going to ask you. So homesteading, when you're like a smaller scale and you can't have a cow, would you substitute a goat in there, like a milk goat, or?
Yeah, goats, sheep. Absolutely. You can get smaller dairy animals. Like most of our, like that, my integrated livestock system that has those chickens, the pigs, and the, typically we have about 4 to 6 milk cows that we milk half of them at any one time. So we're milking 2 to 3 cows at a time, 30 pigs, 200 chickens. That all, in all of our gardens and most of our orchards, is only like 10 or 15 acres. So it's a small percentage of our farm, of the 250. Right. The beef cows kind of take care of the rest.
But you're growing the grain on the rest of it, which...
We aren't anymore, but we were at one point. Now all of our land is in either pasture, or we do a bit of what's called swath grazing, which is you're still planting annual crops, but you're planting them later so that you can swath them right before it snows into these windrows. And then that the snow preserves it so that the cows can eat the swath underneath the snow out in the pasture rather than being in a corral.
Okay. Now, why do you say that the dairy, well, I don't know if a milk goat is considered dairy, but a milk animal, why do you say that that is an integral part of this system? I know that I'll let you answer.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there's several reasons. One is you could live off milk, whether it's dairy or sheep or goat. And there's many people who have, like the Maasai in Africa, who are some of the healthiest people on the planet, literally live off of milk and blood. And that's all they eat. So it's an absolute superfood, and it's probably the lowest hanging fruit in terms of, I think there's like 3,000 plants that a cow can eat worldwide that humans can't.
Okay.
And if you're talking about goats and sheep, there'd probably another couple thousand that we can't eat. So they can literally turn, just wild vegetation. So it's not even like annual crops, or just like whatever's growing naturally, they can walk out there and in 24 hours, they can turn it into, milk, butter, cheese, and meat and fat. And you get huge amounts of fertilizer out of them. Like it's magic. Like
that's what I was wondering, if it had something to do with, not just what they provide for us as food, but as ruminants, what their stomach does to grains for fertilizing ground. I mean, because they have, especially cows with all their stomachs, they're not like other animals, like chickens with one stomach,
So they can take relatively poor quality forage and it basically within 24 hours turn it into the perfect fertilizer that you can put directly onto any crop, and it won't burn them, and like a cow will produce 50 pounds of fertilizer a day.
That's crazy. And then, have you ever integrated any, like you were talking about all the different feeds? So I know that I'm pretty sure you're aware of this, but like something like the white mulberry as a fodder tree. I mean, especially on a small scale. I don't know how well that grows up there, because you're zone 3 and I think they're zone 5.
We're right on the edge. So I've planted honey locust in the past. Okay. Gladiatia tricanthus, for folks who are, if you're trying to look up the Latin here. And then I did some mulberries last year. Okay. The honey locusts have survived. They aren't growing very well, but all I need is one. And so I'm planting, thousands of them to try to get, one or two that will make it through. And then I'll have those genetics and I can start to work with them. But absolutely, like trees are, another one of those kind of magical elements that just provides so much. And once you get it established, they require very little energy to keep going.
Right.
But other species that we have that are working well is things like carragana or Siberian tree shrub. We use, maples, poplars.
Okay.
There's a lot of other silvopasture or agroforestry trees that we are using to.
Okay. And you are using some silvopasture there then.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Cool.
Yep. Yeah. I've there's a few videos that kind of show some of the grazing systems that where our dairy, particularly our dairy cows are, but even our beef cows, like all of our swales, we've planted trees along them. And the goal there is to help, provide shelter, because we live in a very windy area here too.
Okay.
And, there's been a lot of research that's done to show when your house or your animals have access to a shelter belt, they'll use 20% less energy.
Okay.
So that's just what, even if they're not eating it, it can provide benefits of slowing the wind down. Then they're also capturing snow. They're helping to, moderate the water tables. They are, a lot of the trees that we plant, the pioneer ones, they fix nitrogen. So they're actually pulling nitrogen out of the air and injecting it into the ground for free. And sometimes it'll be like tens to hundreds of pounds of nitrogen per acre per year that some of these trees can put in.
I know that you have sea buckthorn.
Yes. Yep.
You have that. Is that something that you use for your animals or just you? Cause I know that you guys, your farm actually sells a tea out of that.
Yep. So absolutely. We use them, not for our animals. I would like to get into sheep and potentially goats for that reason, because they just go so well together, particularly the sea buckthorn and buffalo berry and carragana. Because in order to harvest them, the most efficient way is to cut the whole tree down.
Oh, and then does it just grow back?
Coppice it. Yeah. So you kind of like a rotating coppice.
Okay.
And so in that way, you can keep the berries and the leaves for yourself, but then you can feed the branches to your, sheep or goats.
Very cool.
And then when they pull the eat the small twigs, which they can digest, or they pull the bark off, you're left with firewood. And you, for a small scale system, those species would be just phenomenal. And we have played around with it. It's called tree hay, where you're cutting branches off of certain trees at certain times of the year, and then drying them like you would hay in a barn or something. I have done that with certain species for our cows, but they can't utilize the branches, which is, So that's another system that I think just goes really well. You can create really efficient systems where, every aspect of it's being used from the berries to the leaves, to the branches, to the firewood. And when you prune certain trees that are nitrogen fixing, they actually release more nitrogen into the ground. So if that's those awesome. Tree rows are positioned, say, next to your garden or next to your food forest or fruit trees, like the act of cutting it and harvesting it actually will release fertilizer into the ground. So you can really create these synergistic systems where, 2 + 2 = way more than 4.
Okay. Yeah. I have actually put a bunch of white mulberry and poplar and things out at my property to use for coppicing and hay trees later. And I just got a bunch of sea buckthorn seed. So I'm hoping that I'm able to get some of that planted.
Yeah. But they'll be, they'll be quote invasive in your area.
We'll have to make that work.
Yeah. I don't buy into the whole invasive species narrative, but it's they can like sucker quite aggressively, but it's fine. Yeah. That just means that I can harvest more of them.
That kind of gets me thinking about your whole food forest thing being in rows. So one of the things I did was I planted in rows so that we could get between it with the mower and so we can avoid that spread by just mowing it.
Absolutely.
And in your food forest that you are doing, most food forests I've seen is it's like it's literally a forest where you have done yours into rows. So tell me why you've decided to do the rows.
Yeah. So the I started my first few food forests were put into just like random anywhere they would kind of fit in the landscape, no kind of pattern to it at all. But the, you know, the very quickly I realized it makes it really difficult to manage, very difficult to harvest, very difficult for, and I would even say it's not good for pollination. So like if you go out into a, you know, an ecosystem and you find a wild patch of blueberries or a wild patch of strawberries or raspberries, or they tend to be in clumps where there's, it's a lot of the same species all in one area. And then something else in a big clump. So kind of for all those reasons, and it also fits really well within our water management system, because, you know, all of our swales are on contour or kind of, you know, in curvy lines. And so our food forests then are just basically parallel to those. And that makes it easier for fencing, for mowing. If you're going to use, you know, chicken tractors or, you know, anything, that's having things in rows, there's just so many benefits to it. And it's in a lot of the early books that I read, there's no discussion around like efficiency or design, which in my mind is
becomes an issue when you're.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the reason why people get out of homesteading. Like they fall in love with it, they get into it, and then the workload just becomes undoable.
Yeah, it's drudgery. Yeah. So that's another, you know, aspect of permaculture, which is really interesting, is any element will have its own, its needs and yields. So things that it provides to the system and things that it needs, so yields to the system and it needs from the system. Now, if you as a designer, if your system or if an element needs something that it can't get itself from the system, it will result in work. And if it provides something to the system that you can't put to productive use, it results in pollution. So if you don't design your systems properly, they will suck, and they will eventually destroy the, you know, wherever area they're around. And you can take a simple example. This is like a chicken coop, which is if you don't design the chicken coop so that it can be cleaned really easily, it will result in work for you and pollution for the chickens. And then you need medicated feed, and, you know, the chickens get sick and they don't lose as much production, and then the cascading effects of that are, you know, your gardens are don't have the nutrients that they need, so now you need to bring in, you know, fertilizer from outside, and it just ripples out. So it's really important, like crucially important for people to think about the efficiency of these systems, so that as much as possible your food forest can facilitate all of its own needs from the system, just without doing anything. So just by virtue of how it's designed, it takes care of itself. And then also its yields are also used by the system. And then whatever work you have to do for the system has to be really, really efficient and dialed in. And I have no problem using technology. Like we use tractors. I do use a lot of hand tools, but there is, for every horsepower motor that you have on your property, it's the equivalent of 10 basically Olympic level workers that at your disposal. Right. So like one horsepower is 10 human beings. So even like a small garden tractor is like hundreds of people in a workforce that you can mobilize at, you know, your beck and call to do things. Now, a lot of equipment and technology is used just wastefully and just to no end. But that's like design, and the proper use of technology is an absolute must. And I think a lot of homesteaders fail to do that, and that's why it sucks and they get burnt out and they leave.
Yeah, for sure. I think the workload and a lot of homesteaders are working a job on top of coming from homesteading.
Exactly.
Speaking of that, you're probably, Are you doing carpentry work now, or are you still, so you're 100%
no, I've,
on the farm?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for years, what was it? Like, until like 2014, both my parents and I worked off farm.
Okay.
My parents worked off farm my whole childhood. The farm basically never made money. And now, you know, this last year, you know, we grossed $500,000 in sales on 250 acres.
Wow. I mean, I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. That's very good. I mean, from that's like the full-time work for, there's a full-time salary for three people. And I'm part-time on the farm now, because I may mostly do the marketing, okay. And kind of the business admin. I've got my own property now, but like that, yeah, that's phenomenal compared to what we lost money every year for decades.
That's huge. So. I mean, there's so many farms out there that are not making money, or they're just, it's a wash.
Yeah.
They're just not profitable. Yeah. So to even get profitable and then supply income for three people is in how many years? That sounds like what, 20?
Yeah. So that was 2014 as well. 2012 is when I came.
10 years.
Yeah. I came back, but like I could have done it in five or less if knowing what I know now. Like I basically made mistakes for 5 or 6 years and wasted a bunch of money. But yeah, it's absolutely, right. Yeah, that was I didn't go to university or anything. So that was my tuition.
Yeah. That's the price of learning. I think, I think sometimes we look at mistakes as a bad thing and they're actually a good thing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of my models now is I want to make mistakes as fast as possible.
Right. And learn from them.
Yeah. And learn from a move on. Yeah.
So what do you do in the winter? You did say that you do grow some grain. So how are you feeding all of these animals in the winter up there?
Yeah. So our beef herd is 100% grass fed and finished. Okay. So, you know, we still produce most of our own hay on farm. This year we bought probably about 50% of we had a really bad drought this year. Yeah. And we're also trying to rehabilitate or regenerate our pastures. So for most people, the cost of hay for whatever you're paying for it is actually, you're getting the hay for free and you're buying fertilizer. Okay. So, you know, we found the same guy that grows my organic grain also grows organic alfalfa and forages and stuff. So we bought some hay off of him. And then for our pigs and chickens, we do feed grain to them, but we ferment it, which I think makes a big difference. And we're not using soy, corn, canola, or any other kind of rancid byproducts of the industrial food system. It's like chickens were evolved to eat seeds. They have a gizzard. Right.
Okay.
And so there's nothing wrong with feeding chickens certain kinds of grain. The problem is how those grains are grown, how they're processed. And kind of, you know, what's been put on them. And if they're getting too much, and same thing with pigs, I have no problem feeding grain to pigs, but just like humans, I think it should be fermented to help reduce any of the anti-nutrients and make it more bioavailable for them.
And so that's where some of this milk comes in. So you're using some of your cow's milk for that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we typically get around, you know, 4 to 5 gallons of milk a day. And for the most part, there's either 4 to 5 gallons of skim milk after we take the cream off, or 4 to 5 gallons of whey after we make cheese.
Okay.
There's some days where we take all the milk and that's, we drink that and it doesn't go back. But like for the most part, we have too much milk for our 30 pigs and, you know, 200 chickens just from a few dairy cows. So we ferment their grain in skim milk or whey, which helps provide essential amino acids and enzymes.
Yeah.
It also has
bioavailability.
Yeah. And it provides the nutrients in itself. But the fermentation process, just for the same reason humans benefit from eating sourdough, pigs are the same way, and chickens are the same way too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you growing So you said you're doing soy. Did you say soy, corn, and wheat free feed for your chickens?
Soy, corn, and canola. So our feed is basically wheat, peas, barley, oats is the grain mix. We're starting to this year. The guy that's growing my grain, he's growing all those species together, and we're going to add in things like flax, hemp, sunflowers, all in one polyculture grain. So he's harvesting that's it with one combine. So it's literally like a food forest that we're planting as an annual grain crop, because they've got the emergence, the highs, the mediums, and the lows all in one ecosystem in a grain field. And all that's in the grain, and then we grind that on farm, and we feed that to our animals. We also sell feed off farm as well, because it's really difficult to get the good quality feed that isn't filled with GMOs or chemicals, or it's rancid. And I think in the States it was worse. Like a year ago, there was like the problem, everyone's chickens stopped laying.
Yeah. Yep.
And I can't remember what it was, but there was something they were putting in the feed, wasn't it? It was like a new...
I can't remember either. It was something to do with the feed, but I also think some of it was the protein content had gone down a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like this is where this industrial food system has just gotten so sick. All it does is it looks at these macronutrients and it doesn't care, you know, where the protein's coming from as long as there's protein.
Right.
But it fails. Well, they're using sesame seed oil, which is high protein, but it's rancid because it was pressed on one side of the country and then shipped all the way across. And then they bleach it to try to get the rancid.
Yeah, forget the chemicals they use to even process. Grow. The
yeah.
Oil.
Yeah. So for most people, like that's what they're getting their feed for their animals if they're buying it in the store. So it's already rancid. And it has all these additives and things that are put into that they don't need. We've grown our own grain and made our own feed for decades because we didn't want to deal with that. And now we've gotten to the point where we're producing enough that we're providing about 100 other homesteaders in our area and small farms, awesome, all their feed for their animals too. And it's cheaper than it's beyond organic. It's fresh, all these things. And it's cheaper than what they're paying for those 50 pound bags of feed when they go to the hardware store.
So what is the protein? I mean, are you getting chickens that require less protein? Are you somehow breeding them that way? Or what is your protein?
Yeah.
Where are you getting your protein source?
The peas and the wheat have enough. So that base ration is about 15 to 16% protein. Okay. And with that, and if the chickens are foraging, that's all the protein that they need
and the whey.
But even I have some customers who don't feed the whey, don't feed the milk.
Okay.
They're just giving our grain, but that would be like a layer ration for our grower and chick starter. We add in a certified organic wild caught herring meal. That's really high protein. So it's actually an animal or a fish protein.
So you're not using your fathead minnows yet.
We are, but it's at a small scale that we haven't developed it enough. Okay. But absolutely could be. We also use duckweed is another thing that we use to supplement our protein, which duckweed's 40% protein. We feed that to our pigs and chickens. If we were on like a homestead scale and it was just for ourselves, mm-hmm, absolutely we could provide all the protein needs. We wouldn't need to buy fish meal in from, you know, the East Coast. Because we're bigger, you know, scale. We're larger scale and we're growing feed for all these other farms, we just can't produce it enough. However, my hope is that by adding the feed with the sunflower, the hemp, and the flax, that will boost the protein even higher. And I may not need these fish meals anymore.
That hemp adds in your omegas too.
Yeah. Same with the sunflowers and the flax and like hemp, I think is like 30% protein. Peas are about 20 or 30% protein. Right. But the problem is like, I can't put enough peas in to the ration because peas have their own anti-nutrients that are tricky to deal with too. So yeah, I'm going with a diversity rather than just kind of focusing on the macros. And I guarantee, like, if I gave my feed ration to a nutritionist, they would say, well, an animal, this won't work for an animal. Well, we've been doing it for 30 years, and I've got 100 customers that have done, some of them have done side-by-side trials where they're feeding, you know, a nutritionist balanced ration in the same chicken or in a chicken tractor right next to it. And ours does, they do better on our feed, you know, right next to it.
So with that, they're growing it, if they're going to grow it all in one field, mm-hmm. is that all going to ripen at the same time? Are you feeding some of this green? And how did you find a farmer that was willing to go and do this wild experiment?
So we were our own guinea pigs first. Okay. So I think I've got a few presentations where I've talked about the kind of our multi-species grain mix that we did, which was barley, peas, oats, wheat, and then a whole bunch of different cover crops, so like turnips and radishes and clovers, okay. and in the understory. And there's enough guys around the world that are doing this now that's not so crazy. Like, even on a commercial scale, they're doing, it's called intercropping, where they'll grow, say, like wheat and lentils together in the same field, and they'll combine, or oats and peas is another really common thing that even like massive, you know, 10,000 acre farms are doing, in particularly in organics. So it, like 15 years ago, there's no way I could have convinced anybody to do this. But now that, you know, we've done it, and there's enough other guys that have experimented with it, I had to hunt around a bit. But once I found the guy, I basically showed him the spreadsheet where it's like, you're going to get, here's all the things you're going to get out of this. I can pay you this much per ton for whatever grain you can provide. I'll take as much as you can grow. And it was just, you know, it was money talks kind of a thing. Because in addition to the grain that he's growing, he's getting the straw that he would harvest. If you just plant wheat or oats or barley, the straw has basically no feed value for cows.
Okay.
But if you add in peas and sunflowers and radishes and turnips and all these other things, now that straw is just as valuable as hay, which, like, the difference between a bale of straw and a bale of hay is like, you know, almost 5 to 10x the value. So this guy who grew my grain for me, and I told him, because we've done this before on our own farm, and our animals love it. And there's ways you can feed it so that you're mixing in hay that it, you know, you're not going to have issues with malnutrition or anything. But the value of, by doing it, these multi-species together, the value of the forage that he gets off of the crop for his cows is almost more than the value of the grain itself.
That's awesome. Well, and then on top of it, he's getting the diversity of in his soil of growing.
Yeah, so it's exactly. It's actually like a cover crop. So he's basically growing grain, a cover crop to build his soils, and he's getting forage. And if you put certain species in, you'll get regrowth in the springtime. So you can get an additional grazing off of the spring regrowth before you plant the next year's crop.
Yeah. See, this is just how farming should be. Like, this
exactly,
is
how,
like, the community is operating. You guys are both benefiting from this. The soil is benefiting from this. The animals are benefiting from this. It's just like the perfect situation.
Yeah. This is synergy. This is 2 + 2 = 16.
Yeah.
And what's so cool is, like, go ahead.
So they are getting, so some of this is probably green then, right? Like, the grain is not completely, or
no, it's all dried down. So, like,
okay.
You have to play around with them, like the variety selection for what, cause there's different maturity dates for certain grain. But,
that makes sense.
But what's interesting about it is, and this is again, one of the aspects of synergy. If you plant just a pea crop by itself, it's really hard to harvest it by itself because of the way peas grow. They lay flat on the ground. And so guys, when they're going to do a pea crop, they literally have to roller compact their fields with like giant compaction, like steel drums filled with concrete to flatten any field, any rocks before they plant it. Because when they harvest with their combines, their headers are so low to the ground that any little rock, the combine will pick it up and it'll wreck $1 million combine.
Okay.
Versus with this way, when you're planting things like wheat and oats and barley that grow really tall, the peas have a trellis that they can climb up.
That is amazing.
But in addition to that, certain things like peas, they are difficult to ripen, and you almost have to harvest them before they're ripe, because if they are ripe, they shell out so easily. Versus with this system, you can harvest them. The peas won't necessarily be ripe, but because the barley and the oats and stuff will be more than ripe, it kind of, when you put it into a bin, it evens out. You know, this is the same way. Like if you are, you know, if you drop your phone in water, you put it into a bowl of rice.
Right.
It'll pull the moisture out of it. So that's basically what happens with these intercrops. As long as you don't get too much of the things that wouldn't necessarily be ripe, the stuff that is ripe will be kind of drier than it should be, and it'll kind of balance out in the bin. And worst case scenario, you could put it through a dryer if you had to, but
that uses a lot of energy though.
Yeah. And like, you know, this year we did, it was a wet fall, and we had sunflowers, wheat, barley, oats, and peas all together in one crop. And it was like well below the you know, critical moisture threshold.
What you're doing in the winter. Are you doing that year round?
For feed?
Yeah.
We feed grain.
You're doing that with pigs and chickens.
Yeah. Yeah. But with my pigs and chickens, we limit feed them. So we only feed them, say, you know, once or twice a day, and then they go forage for their third meal.
Okay.
So I would still say, you know, the majority of the, or not the majority, probably a quarter of their diet is coming from the forage that they're getting themselves.
Right.
But we wouldn't get the production if we weren't feeding the grain. Would take a lot longer to get the same.
Yeah, I mean, like pigs are one of the animals that it's okay for them to get grain. Unlike a cow, it's not, you know, they're permanent. Yeah.
Yeah. And like I do give a little bit of grain to my dairy cows, but just as a treat. Like they get a few pounds a day versus like in the dairy barns, they basically force feed them grain, and they'll give them, you know, 10, 12 pounds of grain a day, which then the milk becomes, you know, it's not as healthy because it's inflammatory because they're not designed to eat that as well.
So if you were doing this like on a smaller scale, I was thinking about that with the grains.
Mm-hmm.
You could probably, I don't know if you could find a farmer, maybe a bunch of my friends and I can advocate a farmer to grow like you have, but you're doing like the forage that you're doing with your pigs, they're actually going out and doing that themselves. You're not bringing it to them. I mean, I've seen your videos. They're going out and getting like the cattails.
Yep.
And do you do anything else with the pigs besides cattails? Do you like plant radish or any of that?
We have done some stuff where the, like say that swath grazing mix that we talked about earlier, where it's you're planting basically the same, like, you know, barley, peas, wheat, oats, sunflowers, turnips, all that stuff. You just plant a little bit later, and then so it won't start to dry off in the fall. It's actually still green, and then you cut it green, put it into swaths. We have grazed our dairy cows and our pigs in a system like that together, where the pigs will go and root up the turnips and the beets and the radishes, and they'll eat some of the forage itself. But what's cool is with that, the pigs will also eat any of the grain heads that make it through the stomachs of the cow, will get concentrated in their manure. And I've got videos on my website or on my YouTube channel where like I'll open up a cow pie, and it looks like a barley sandwich. Like it's like half barley, and the pigs will literally eat like a whole pile. Like,
yeah. They think that's amazing, too. Right?
Yeah. It's fantastic for them. Like, so there's a lot of things that we could do. And this is the place that I'm in right now, is like I've kind of done proof of concept on a lot of these little systems, and my niche in my ecosystem is like I'm an inventor. So once I do something and it works, like I don't want to like scale it and like figure, I just want to go to the next thing and invent the next thing. I have no doubt that you could feed cows. I know guys that are feeding pigs on silage. They're not feeding any grain at all. And they're just with forage and silage, because the silage is broken down enough. So absolutely, there are systems that you could develop like this. And if you were to make like a spreadsheet of all the different forage resources, the cattails, the mulberries, you know, the honey locust when they drop, when the turnips
acorns
are ready, and if you made a spreadsheet of like when all those things were ready, and just filled in the gaps with, okay, well, we need something in May because that's a really hard. So what are we going to feed them in May? Well, we could do squash. Absolutely. You could do it.
And
there's guys that are doing this with chickens that are grain free. So 100%, it can be done. Because we are kind of going the farm scale route and one pig uses about 2,000 pounds of feed to get to full, of grain to get full size. And I'm raising, 30 or 40 for sale off farm. So the scale kind of starts to break down where they wouldn't be able to get that much forage in the distance they could walk from my hub. So I found it better to be kind of the 80-20 where it's I'm just trying to reduce the amount of feed that they're eating with the cattails, still giving them grain.
Right.
And, on a home scale side of things, you could totally raise a pig and chickens without purchasing any feed from off farm.
Right.
But it takes a while to develop these systems. And I would also add in, there's nothing wrong with if you buy in grain to feed for your chickens or pigs, you're basically, again, you're buying the fertilizer and getting the grain for free.
I think I like the idea of a mix of that, still using the grain, but then adding to that. I think that just creates a sound system. I mean, if something happens.
Exactly. It's totally, I'm at the stage where, prepare for the worst and hope for the best kind of a thing. And so, we're set. And if we have to go back to a home scale production, I know I could raise pigs just with dairy cows. The dairy cows would provide enough of the protein and fats for for our chickens and pigs to make it through, and all the other forage resources that we have. But I also think, the ideal system can solve some of these kind of political and social problems that we're facing. The optimal civilization isn't where everyone's homesteading. I do think it makes sense to have specialized farmers at a certain scale that makes sense for the ecosystem, because once you've got that division of labor, then other people can focus on, building the technology and
your creative brain working on creativity.
but not even mine. There's people we're talking to each other across thousands of miles with this amazing technology, and that wouldn't happen unless there was a surplus of food and someone could spend their whole life working on have nothing to do with agriculture. So that's kind of where I'm at, where it's like agriculture is the foundation of civilization. That the homesteading for me is that it's an insurance policy. I hope we never have to use it. Mm-hmm. But it gives me the freedom and peace of mind to kind of, bite the hand that feeds me and know that, know that I can call the system out and not worry they're going to cut me off my food ration tickets. Long-term, I guess answering your question around could you grow all of your own feed and be a self-sufficient farm? Absolutely. But I don't think that's the best thing. I think it's better to, like you said, find a local farm who can specialize in that, who already has the equipment, and help them transition so that they're growing this kind of regenerative grain. And because that will free up, everyone in your community to then focus on what they're passionate and really, really good at. You can still have a few chickens in your backyard, but the effort to try to get a system where you don't need any grain or any feed for your pigs, it's hard. You can do it, but that's your full-time thing.
Yeah. And I think it's becoming more and more unusual for people to have, your family has been obviously homesteading this piece of land for a long time. It's becoming more and more unusual for people to have large swaths of land. Where I live at in Michigan, which is northern Michigan, way northern Michigan, we don't have massive farms that have, when I say massive, I'm talking 200 acres is really unusual.
Yeah.
Out west, thousands and thousands of acres is not unusual, but here it's really unusual for people to even have 100 acres. So to find that farmer here that does have a couple hundred acres and that equipment, to me, it feels just the obvious yeah. thing to do. And then it also builds that community resilience.
Yeah. Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. yeah. Well, and it's been so cool. Cause like all of my customers are homesteaders and, you know, they're all working off farm jobs and, yeah, and, but they want to have this piece and like just the, they're so grateful that we've been able to kind of solve this piece of the puzzle because in our probably not the same in your areas, but you can't buy feed now in our area unless you have what's known as a premise ID number, which is basically a certificate from the government where you have to tell them how many animals you have, where they're located, and all these. You can't buy feed, you can't buy dog food, you can't buy udder balm, like salve for your cow's teats. So they're slowly starting wow. to close the noose around us.
Now how is that a new thing? I did not realize well, that
they've had it for years, like this premise ID number, but it started out where I was like, well, it's just for certain things. And then now it's like you literally can't go into a hardware store and buy anything animal related, like for food or medicine without one of these premise ID numbers.
So who issues that? Is it like a veterinarian?
It's a government application that you have to tell them.
Wow. Yeah, here just recently they have taken a lot of Medicaid. Well, I shouldn't say I know exactly what medications they are because we don't use them, but
yeah.
they've taken medications out of some of the ag stores and you now have to go to the veterinarian to get them.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like that slow road.
Yeah.
That is crazy. So when somebody buys through you, obviously,
there's no paperwork here. Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy. Wow. It just blows my mind that you. Just,
yeah. And it's going to get worse. Like if you listen to the folks that are, you know, planning these agendas, they're openly saying they're going to make animal agriculture illegal.
Because supposedly animal agriculture is bad for the environment,
which you have shown
that the way you're doing things is actually better for the environment because you've brought water back.
Yeah. Well, the water and the, like one of my goals is that I want to have a new bird that I don't recognize come through my farm every year. And every year for 10 years, that's been the case. I have to get the bird book out. What's that guy? So like we're increasing biodiversity every year. There's new plant species that I've never seen before. We're improving soil health, all these different things.
Well, yeah, and you brought back muskrats that came from who knows where, and you got fathead minnows that you don't know where they came from. And yet this is supposedly bad for the environment. It just blows my mind that.
Yeah. And they're like, there's the latest
these
one.
These are people that are so removed from actually being on a good quality farmer homestead that they don't even understand.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the latest report I saw was, it was from the World Economic Forum, which was how like small scale kind of homesteading, backyard gardens type agriculture was more bad for the environment than industrial agriculture, which is.
I kind of take that as a compliment.
I do.
So many people are gardening now that we have reached their to-do list that they're trying to make us look bad. So, I mean, that's kind of a compliment to me.
I agree. And I don't, you know, as I'm talking about this, I'm not worried about this stuff either. To me, I think it's the only power they have is that which we give them.
Right.
I don't think they're going to come out with the military and they're going to do it all by voluntary. They're going to like the mandates, you know, the last few years. It wasn't forced. It was all free choice. So just remember that all the stuff, it's voluntary. They're making us offers. We can politely say no thanks. And they might make it hard for us or try to use other businesses to enforce their policies. But if we just step back and say, sorry, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to grow feed for my family, my community. And then the feed industry is regulated. Like it's illegal for me to do what I'm doing to grow grain because I'm calling it feed. And if they ever get, you know, catch me on it, I'll say, okay, I'll change the name to dog food or what, to something else that isn't regulated.
I mean, we have some of that here with, like, for example, the raw milk. A lot of people sell milk it's for animals. It's for, you know, it's animal feed, you know, but that still blows my mind that you have to ask permission to even have like a dog and get dog food and chickens and get, I mean, in some places you do have to ask permission here to get, well, you don't have to ask permission. but your amount of chickens are limited, especially in urban and suburban areas. But we don't have to ask permission to go by feed. That just kind of, I didn't realize that.
And that's, that's a new thing that like just came up just in the last few years. It's been wild to see how like our local governments are working kind of in lockstep with these, you know, globalist organizations where, you know, like our local counties are putting out webinars now for farmers about what, you know, how to prepare for animal pandemics.
Yeah. The whole bird flu thing has been definitely the last few years more on the radar.
Yeah. So that, I think that's where it's going. And I think that, the best way for us to stay away from that is just, you know, fly under the radar, start developing our own local communities.
Yeah.
And kind of build the revolution one homestead at a time.
I agree. On that note, I wanted to ask you, what is your, you know, what are things looking like in the future? You have your website, which is, I'm trying to remember, buildyourhomestead.com. Buildingyourhomestead.com. And we'll put links in the show notes on the website. But what are your future plans? You said that you're more working with marketing and the creative side of things now. Tell me about
that. Yeah. So I still manage the farm with my folks. I bought my own 30-acre property that is going to be my own research laboratory. I've got a lot of, new forage systems that I want to play around with, things with insects, and like I don't want to eat the bugs, but my chickens would love to eat bugs.
Right? Yeah. Like some what do they call that? Roaches and
So like stuff like that, and I've got some new versions of my duckweed system, and I'm going to continue doing that R&D side of things on the on our farm and my homestead, but now that those systems are working really well and I've got a farmhand that's kind of managing a lot of that stuff for me, it's freeing me up to be able to work more one-on-one with other homesteaders who want to do the same thing.
So you're doing some consulting then?
Consulting and design. Well, one of the things that I've realized is that, in the same way that most people wouldn't find it difficult to design their own house, like if they're going to build a brand new house from scratch, they'd probably work with some kind of a home builder or an architect. And these are like, houses aren't complex. There's like four or five kinds of rooms. There's bedrooms, there's bathrooms, there's a kitchen, there's a living room, and there's hallways. Like that's like, but we got to figure out how do we arrange that, in a few thousand square feet so that it's efficient and beautiful and allows, there's a lot of elements and most people can't get throughout their head around that. And I think one of the problems that I've seen in the permaculture and kind of regenerative ag space is that all the education and courses is trying to get people to do this for themselves. And so it'd be akin to like, I want to build my own house. I'm going to go take a 4-year program to be an architect. It's like, it doesn't make sense. Now, so what I want to do is I've spent the last 10 years basically becoming an architect for farm design. I've made tons of mistakes on our own place. I've had the opportunity to work with other clients to help design their properties out. I've tried to teach other people and you can do it, but it takes 4 years. So this is another example of the division of labor is like, it's better for certain people to specialize in homestead design or farm design and let other people specialize in the management of those systems. So, I've got a great team that I work with now where we're all homesteaders ourselves. We've got a landscape architect, a literal landscape architect who can, take my crayon drawings for, how farms should look and turn them into actual, like really functional drawings for anywhere from a few acres to, the largest property I've worked on was a 30,000 acre ranch. And thinking about how to mimic these ecosystems and manage water flows and access and where buildings should be located and all these different things to build these interconnections and these synergistic relationships between elements so that the properties will be efficient long term. And if you can get the right, the right thing and the right amount of the right thing at the right time in the right place, the rest of the stuff's easy. So that's kind of where we're at right now is we want to help homesteaders anywhere in the world or farmers to design and develop their land So we can, you know, we can design it for them. We can design it with them, or they can design it themselves. Like, I've got a book, I've got courses on how to design this stuff. So we can kind of meet people wherever they're at and provide whatever level of support they need, whether it's just, you know, an hour of consulting here and there, or a full on, you know, homestead design package where we work with you for a base, like a month or sorry, 2 months straight to, you know, clarify your goals, diagnose your whole property, come up with a design, come up with an implementation strategy, and then a long-term monitoring approach for you to make sure that you're on the right track, and kind of anywhere in between there.
Yeah, I think, and that's all you can, people can find all of that on your website.
Yeah. Yeah. Buildingyourhomestead.com has, and there's also free resources on there. There's links to my book, and I've got a podcast
about your book. What was the title of your book?
So it was called Building Your Permaculture Property.
Okay. That's right. Yeah.
And that was a 5-step process to design and develop land. But, and it's, you know, a great book. And that's the process that I use to design and develop land. I just started to realize that for a lot of people, like, some people want to become an architect.
Yes.
And if that's the book you should read. If you want to be a homesteader and just farm and just or keep your off-farm job or whatever it is, and also homestead, then I think it makes sense to, and there's lots of other great designers. You mentioned Ben Falk. There's guys like Mark Shepard. There's, there's lots of kind of farmer homestead design companies out there. Probably one of the biggest mistakes that I made early on is that I, even though I wanted to become an architect, is I didn't lean on the professionals that were already there enough. And it would have saved me a ton of time and tens of thousands of dollars.
Okay.
If I would have done that earlier.
Well, is there anything else that you wanted to mention before we close the podcast?
And I'll just close it with one of my like favorite quotes from Bill Mollison, who's the founder of permaculture. And he said, because this is really my impetus for why I got into, farming and homesteading and permaculture. He said the central problem is that, you know, the central problem with all revolutions is that they're utterly dependent upon the systems they're trying to overthrow, and that they produce more bullets and words than they do food and shelter. So he said the most important thing that we need to do is to transition from consumers to producers. And that's why I love the homesteading ethos. That's why we changed the name of our, you know, the company to focus on homesteading, is because it's there's really this desire for production and to, you know, exit the current system. We don't want to fight. We don't want to, you know, words and bullets. Screw all that. It's not going to work. We just want to withdraw and take responsibility for our own families and our communities and scale up from there. And I love that vision, that vision that Bill put forward, which he also summarized as, you know, permaculture is a revolution disguised as gardening. And so I think a lot of people, like, that's what draws them to it, whether it's conscious or not, I don't know. But for me, it always was. And I'm really trying to push that more, is that whatever problem you see in the world, like, the best way to solve it is gardening or homesteading.
I feel like that. Yeah. I feel like that for me. I mean, I love it, and that's my passion. So Well, thank you so much for your time, Dakota. As I told you before, I maybe even said at the beginning, but I have enjoyed watching you over the last several years, and you're putting out a little more content now, and I've just really enjoyed what you're doing. And thank you for your contribution to permaculture and the movement.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Rachel.
Thanks.
I hope you gained some actionable insights from this podcast about how you can fight the powers that shouldn't be by building your own homestead. If you did, please take the time to share this episode and click all those buttons to like, rate, and follow. This helps spread our message, it makes sure that you never miss an episode, and it sends a middle finger to globalists like Klaus Schwab. I also suggest that you sign up to my newsletters directly on my websites that are in the show notes. With the Government of Canada recently passing Bill C-11, the Online Streaming Act, the threat of me being censored or removed from mainstream media platforms like this one is becoming a reality. If that time ever comes, we can stay connected. Thanks again for listening, and take care until next time.